Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 11 for October 10th, 2009. Where's Leo?
This Week in Google is brought to you by GoToAssist Express, the easy way to provide instant tech support to your customers remotely. Support smarter with GoToAssist Express. For a free 30-day trial, go to GoToAssist.com/twig.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, number 11. What's the matter with this picture? Where's Leo? Leo is off in Dubai, sunning himself and having kebabs, I'll bet, and having a good time. So you're stuck with me trying to sit inadequately in his shoes. But thank goodness we have to the rescue, as always, Gina Trapani.
Hello.
Hello, Gina.
I'm missing
Gina
Leo very much.
Fancy new microphone.
Yes, I've got a fancy new microphone today, and it is a little weird to be here without the president of the internet, but we have some awesome guests, so I'm excited. It's going to be good.
Speaking of whom, why don't you introduce guest number one?
Guest number one, I'm assuming, we'll go with Liz Lawley, a friend of mine and a brilliant person who I've been dying to have on the show, and we have a really good reason to have her on the show. She's got this excellent project, which I can't wait to hear her talk about today.
And then guest number two, we are delighted to have Matt Cutsback from Google, having had approval. And we have the new hairless Matt. What's the deal, Matt?
Yes, I lost a bet. And so I have a good aerodynamic coefficient of friction now. I can swim very well. I can cut through the air very efficiently.
Is it cold, Matt?
It can get a little cold. Yeah, I need to get a little cap or something like that.
Well, why don't we start with Liz's project, because it's exciting and a new kind of way to tie the virtual and the real world together. So, Liz, why don't you give us the URL and the story?
Okay, so the URL is picturetheimpossible.com. And the basic idea behind it is we decided at RIT that we wanted to work with our local newspaper to essentially try to save newspapers, which was a
small
goal.
That's Rochester Institute of Technology and Rochester.
That's correct. Rochester Institute of Technology. I teach in an interactive games and media department there, and I run the lab for social computing. And the newspaper wanted to do something collaborative with us. And I said, how about an alternate reality game? And they said, that's a great idea. Let's do it now. And then I had this moment of panic because I've, of course, never actually built an alternate reality game. I've only played them. And suddenly I was in charge of one. So we've been working with them for about a year now, and the game launched in September. And the whole point of the game is to try to make the newspaper more relevant to audiences that haven't cared about it in the past by integrating the community features of what it does, the news aspects, and really connecting people up with the tangible aspects of the paper as well. So every week we do online games, which are sort of the simple, less exciting parts of it, everything from slider puzzles to jigsaw puzzles. But we also do scavenger hunts around the city. We do a set of really challenging puzzles in the paper, including some that are spread out over multiple editions and multiple weeks, so that people have to collect the paper and assemble the puzzle pieces together. And then lots of individual challenges where we print our players winning photographs and screens from their videos and things like that in the paper. And the newspaper has totally stepped up on this. And in addition to helping a lot with the development, they've also devoted the entire back page of the sports section every week for 7 weeks to coverage of the game, so that the game has become really an integral part of the paper. And what we're seeing is a big bump in the number of people buying single copies of the paper. And now, what we don't know is if when they stop with the game, they will keep getting the paper. And
but isn't the paper itself a little bit, Liz, isn't the paper itself, pardon me for being, you know, cyber god, but a little bit irrelevant as long as they maintain a relationship with each other and the community through the paper brand? Isn't that a real victory?
It's a huge victory, and we're really excited about what's been accomplished. I mean, what we're seeing in terms of the level of commitment and enthusiasm and engagement of the users has been huge. The time spent on site is much better than what they get in the normal paper site itself, but also people are really thinking about, talking about, aware of the paper in a way that they weren't before. And, you know, in a perfect world, what I would love to see is for game developers to become part of newspaper staff that do this on an ongoing basis, that if the only reason people are buying the paper is because of the game, that's great. There are people who only buy a paper because of the sports news or because of the local news or because of the comics page. There's no reason that the game can't be equally important. And we're really trying to play with the tangible aspects of the paper too, folding things, building things, playing with the physical aspects of the paper itself. And so far, it's been really successful.
I did a big project at City University of New York where I teach in new business models for news that I've mentioned on the show before. And we used kind of some industry standard numbers for engagement with newspaper sites. And it's sinfully low. Newspaper sites run about 12 page views per user per month. Compare that with Facebook, which is 12 per user per day. And if we think that newspapers are truly involved and part of their community, that's the demonstration that they're not. So making games... Right. Finding new ways to bring people together, new ways to be of the community, that's what a paper is, I think.
That's what we're hoping, you know? We want this to be deeply engaging. We want people to see the paper as relevant and as connecting them to other people. And we're seeing some really amazing stuff. I mean, at this point, we're about halfway through the game, a little over halfway. And so, you know, a lot of it is still anecdotal evidence until we can sit down at the end and crunch all the numbers. But it's, for example, very common right now for groups of people from the game to get together in local coffee shops with the Sunday paper to solve the puzzles together as the puzzles get harder and harder and they need collaborative help in solving them. Today, Alon Leaf, who's one of the pioneers of ARG development, was in town for the weekend to give a talk, and he and I went and did the scavenger hunt downtown and bumped into a whole bunch of people who were walking with their papers, with their mobile phones, doing our scavenger hunt and connecting to the city and to each other. And so we're seeing really deep engagement from people. We had 150 people create photosynths of horse statues around the city and submit those the very first weekend of the game when we first launched it, something we thought hardly anybody would do. We asked our players to take pictures, including at least three firsts from Rochester. So, you know, Western Union was founded here, the first beauty salon was here, Kodak and Xerox and all kinds of things like that. And we got 150 extraordinary creative images that then several of which were printed in the paper. And, you know, we're just seeing that this brings people much more deeply into the experience because they care about it because they're engaged in interacting with it.
Gina, so, Liz, do you think for games... Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
I was going to ask a question. Go ahead.
I was going to say, for people who haven't played ARGs or alternate reality games before, so you and a group, you teach at RIT and a group of students there are working with the local paper. Tell me what the alternate reality is like. I mean, what is it like for readers? What's the game like and what's the timeline like?
So we made a decision when we started that we didn't want this to be a typical ARG in some ways. We talked with a bunch of ARG developers, and one of the things they warned us about is that in a lot of ARGs, what happens is that 80% of the content is designed for 20% of the players, the people who are really hardcore, solve every puzzle, dig up every clue, devote 30 hours a week to the game. And we wanted this to be something that could have a casual user base and have the casual users be considered important as well. So we essentially created two things. First, there is a narrative behind it. You know, ARGs generally have a storyline behind them where you're turning your day-to-day world into the game board for some kind of narrative storytelling going on. So what we said is, you know, let's imagine that there was a secret society here in Rochester, one that's been here for several hundred years, and that all of the important figures here, you know, the Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass and the founders of Western Union and Kodak Tech and Xerox, all of them have been members over the years. But lately, the society has been racked by a lot of internal conflict, and there are three factions fighting for control of the society. And they really want to revitalize the organization with younger people. And so they're using this game as a way to identify new members for the society. And so there's an underlying narrative that if you dig, you can find it. There are Twitter feeds, there are blog posts, there are puzzles and things like that. But for probably 80% of the users, what they're seeing is something really straightforward. If you go to Picture the Impossible and sign up, every week for 7 weeks, we've got a different theme. And the themes are all drawn from the history of Rochester, the important community aspects. So week one, we did arts and crafts to coincide with the local arts festival. Week two, we did local food and drink. This week is imaging and optics because we've got Bausch & Lomb here. We've got pictometry here, Kodak, Xerox. And so within each week for the theme, we have five different web-based flash activities that people can do, you know, map games, video quizzes that we do in partnership with the local TV station. And so you can play those without ever leaving your computer. We also have local games. We do one individual challenge and one scavenger hunt every week so that people can go out and explore the city and find the things we're pointing them to. And then there's at least two newspaper puzzles every week, things that one in the Sunday paper and one somewhere else in the paper during the week. So for many of our players, that's all they see. They're really not that interested in the story, in going down the rabbit hole, but there is a rabbit hole there for the people that want to play with it. And then part of the story in terms of the people being in factions is when you choose a faction, when you first log into the game, each faction is associated with a local charity. Each week we add up all the points that our players achieve, and the faction that has earned the most points in aggregate, their charity gets the largest donation from the money we got from a foundation. So there's a reason for people to keep coming back to the site, because every week their points count, and not only to helping them get invitations to a party at the end, but also towards helping the charities. And we're seeing some great stuff, like people who have gone to the charities and asked for tours and done videos featuring them because they really want a centering point for their faction to be involved with. So a lot of this was about defining what we wanted people to accomplish in the game. And we did it. You know, we talked with Jane McGonigal, and she said, people need to know, what are the verbs you want to associate this? And we said, well, we want them to give back, we want them to learn, and we want them to explore. And so far, we've been amazingly successful on all three of those.
What's exciting to me about this is, well, Fred Wilson at AVC.com, the venture capitalist blogger, wrote a post today talking about the golden triangle, things that come in between mobile and live, and now I'm going to forget the third. I'll remember it in a second. And I threw in local as well. And I think there's something to the idea of stuff that comes in together and brings it together. We talked about this on the show last week, the idea of the annotated world, of tying together the internet with the real world. What's neat about this is that it's local and it's live and it keeps things going, which probably is a good segue into the next topic for the week, which is Google's mobile strategy coming together. Pardon me while I look off screen here to our Wave, which we have. there's a whole bunch of news here. Let me just list it real quickly. Android is finally coming to AT&T, says the rumor, which seems to be fairly solid, that the Dell phone using Android is going to come to AT&T, and that means that Google now gets hegemony among the mobile operators. Number two, Google and AT&T continue sniping over VoIP. Google tries to argue this week that it's not really a phone company. It's just a feature, so it has the right to block certain calls. AT&T, importantly, backed down on VoIP and now allows VoIP applications. Next, Google has added rich advertising, rich AdSense to its mobile pages and mobile apps, which I think is really important. Then we have, I think, some news on Cyanogen and so on. So there's a lot going on with the mobile application, and Eric Schmidt's been talking about local and mobile. Matt, fill us in a little bit about where you think local and mobile go together with search.
Yeah, I think they go together really well if you think about it, because It's kind of nice that, you know, we have voice recognition going now, and then we know where your mobile phone is, and you can always correct that location if you want to. So you can do a search, and I've done this like last night, where you're searching for El Rio or someplace in San Francisco, and we will show you the closest El Rio, you know, because we think we know where you are. And then we can also say, oh, here are some directions if you'd like to go there. And one extra thing that I don't even know whether made the list was we just added search options on the mobile search. So now you can say, okay, I'd like to show me results within the last 24 hours or something like that. So it's the same functionality that you can do on desktop search, but it's now available on your mobile phone. And I mean, if you think about all the different Android phones that are coming out, especially in the holiday sort of season, there really is a lot of momentum for people to be able to hack their phone, install applications, do all sorts of weird, cool, neat new stuff. So I'm looking forward to it.
Gina, have you been writing many Android things?
I haven't been doing much Android development, but it is really exciting. What's happening on Android is really exciting right now. I mean, basically this holiday season, CTIA, which is a wireless conference, happened here in San Diego this week, and there are a couple of announcements. Tomorrow, the HTC Hero comes out on Sprint, which will be an Android phone. Samsung is going to do the Moment phone on November 1st. I mean, essentially you're looking at Android phones. You know, you're going to have lots of choice in handset and lots of different flavors of the operating system as well, depending on the carrier, and choice when it comes to carrier as well, which is, I think, is what is the difference between, you know, the iPhone and Android right now, is that you just have a lot more choices and you can customize. And hey, you like the flip out keyboard? Great. You can get a handset. I haven't played around with any of the new Android handsets yet, mostly because I'm too cheap to get a new handset before my contract is up. But I am going to be playing with the new, I think the Hero, I think tomorrow.
I want a new business right now. Maybe I should, it's our wish list, but I want to create a business where we can gang together and five of us can buy phone handsets and trade them back and forth.
Yes, and just try them out. And yeah, exactly. I guess if I asked, I could get review units. I hate taking review units and, you know, so.
Well, now the Federal Trade Commission will come after you and throw you a fine if you don't admit to your sin, if you dare write about them.
Exactly. The other kind of interesting Android thing that happened is a donut dropped last week. I just got it on my G1, and a donut is the new update to Android. All the Android updates are named after pastries for a reason I'm not sure. So the previous one was cupcake, and donut is 1.6. And a few weeks ago on this show, I had featured the Cyanogen custom Android ROM, which I had hacked my phone and installed this custom ROM. And then there was a little tussle between Google and the developer Cyanogen. Google said, hey, there are some closed source apps in this ROM that you're redistributing, and you can't do that. The operating system is open source, but not the apps. And so the great news this week, and actually this happened last week, but now Cyanogen, who is the developer, has actually released a version. He's released a version of the ROM that does not include any of the closed source apps, and that he's also offering a utility that lets you back up the apps, which you have a license for because you purchased the phone, and then reinstall them onto his ROM. So, and that'll be in the show notes. So great news to Cyanogen. Really happy that he was able to work that out with Google. Happy to see how that worked out. So yeah, it will be interesting. I mean, I'm happy to see that Sprint is, you know, taking on the Android platform, and which is much more open and has just better apps, and will let people, you know, walk around with their smartphones and participate in more community, you know, games like Picture of the Impossible.
What do we think about Dell doing a phone? I have a little bit of a relationship with Dell going back to unhappier than happier times. But it's about time for them to get into this, I think, isn't it?
There's certainly been some reports, but I don't know whether anything's been confirmed quite yet. But you know, you get Android on Verizon. It's going to be an exciting holiday season, I think, because there's a lot of stuff coming out, and so whichever carrier you prefer, I think you'll have a lot more options, which is something that's really nice.
If one of you were going to get a phone for me for, I don't know, Christmas, which Android phone do you think is the hot one to lust after?
I would hold off a little while. Because, you know, it seems like the announcements are coming fast and furious for the time being. And so if you can sort of wait and see how the holiday season sort of shakes out, then you'll probably have a little more ability to sort of, you know, take a look at different things. The Hero and MyTouch, there's a lot of good ones right now, but you know, it seems like we're in a period where we're getting a lot of announcements really quickly. And so if you sort of give it just a little bit of time, I suspect you know, you'll have all sorts of different options, and then you'd hate to have one and then you know, a new one comes out 3 days later or something like that. So there's a lot of good ones. The Hero, for example, looks very good as far as the ones that I've heard of. So
yeah, I think I'm a big fan of being a late early adopter when it comes to gadgets. I always kind of wait to see what people say when they have it. I do with the iPhone too. It's like, let's just wait to see, you know, what comes out and what people think of it, and then make a decision. Although you can play the waiting game forever because there's always going to be something new.
I saw that on TechCrunch just before we came on the air, somebody, there was a picture of a guy who put his Palm Pre in his glass of beer, which I think was a review of it. Liz, did you find the paper is understanding mobile and understanding the idea of trying to deal with people in and out two ways with their mobile devices?
To an extent, you know, the person we've been working with at the paper is now the managing editor, but when we started with her, she was the head of multimedia and innovation for the paper. And she really gets it, and she's been hiring a lot of really good people in the development side. And actually, the Rochester Gannett paper has a fabulous mobile site in terms of getting information out. For the going back in, we, you know, they don't quite have that in place. So we've been using a platform called Scavenger from a company in Boston that we've been really delighted with for the mobile scavenger hunts. But I think they see the value of it, and it's more simply a resource allocation issue, is having enough people in, you know, this current newspaper economy to be able to build the kinds of tools they'd like to for mobile interaction.
Liz, I know what... I'm sorry, Jeff. I keep cutting you off. It's the problem not having Leo in the driver's seat.
We can't see each other in video this time because there's no view of Uncle Leo.
Right, so exactly.
I apologize. I'm interrupting. Go ahead, Leo.
I just was going to say, you know, this show is called This Week in Google, but it's really about cloud computing. And even though Matt, you know, works for Google and we talk about Google a lot, it's about the cloud in general. And Liz, I wanted to ask you, I know that Bing was a big sponsor of Picture the Impossible. So I wanted to ask you, were there any tie-ins with Bing or was it, you know, how did that sponsorship work?
There is definitely a tie-in. We're using Bing Maps a lot on the site. We're using Bing Maps for all of the local games. So, for example, we'll do a bird's eye local image of the starting point for the scavenger hunt, which has been great. And for us, that was actually a really nice local tie-in, because while Redmond isn't local, their bird's eye images all come from Pictometry, and Pictometry is a Rochester-based company. So that, for us, we've tried to, you know, to sort of eat our own dog food as much as possible, to be as local as possible in all of our content. All of our video content comes from a local TV station. All of our images come from the Democrat and Chronicle photographers. And so having Pictometry from the Bing Maps was great. If we'd had, you know, I should say that we did this on a budget of nothing, with no staff assigned to it. So we have begged, borrowed, and stolen everything that we needed to make this happen along the way. So there are a lot of things we would have done differently or more of if we had had resources to work with. So there are other ways we would have loved to have involved things like better local search, better integration of news and video and things like that. We've learned an enormous amount doing this, and moving forward, we'll do some other stuff. But for now, the major Bing integration for us has been the maps. And, you know, I have to give them major props, A, for giving us some money to help keep the lights on, and B, for saying, sure, of course you can go on This Week in Google. So
yeah, that's really cool. Very, very cool. I'm happy to hear that they helped you out, because it's a great project. Are you going to open source the plans for the game so that other newspapers can do the same? I think, had we talked about that at some point?
We had talked about that. Because we built this quickly and without resources, this is the version one of the underlying platform, and I don't want to open source it because I don't really think anybody else wants to work with it in the form that it's currently in. It's one of these duct tape and string constructions where it's doing what it needs to do for right now. But right, we've learned so much that, in fact, my next round of this is going to be to look for funding, either grant funding or, you know, business funding to build the robust platform, the scalable platform that we could give to other people. And absolutely, we want to make it available. I mean, if it's only us that does it, that's not fun. You know, we want everybody to do it. And I know Gannett has been looking at it as something that they could use in other markets as well. So once we can get a good version of it together, a solid version, the plan is absolutely to put it out there so that other people can work with it.
That's fantastic.
What's exciting about this is that you have a newspaper company that's trying to increase engagement, do new things. This week in the Great Hall, the people in at Tiananmen Square in China, you had the head of the Associated Press, Tom Curley, and Rupert Murdoch, the head of News Corp, both continuing this rant and rail against Google aggregators, bloggers, calling them thieves, not understanding the link economy, not understanding the idea that the audience is the distributor of what they do. And if they put themselves behind, I don't know, a great wall, that they're going to just cut themselves off from the world. And so when you see these experiments like what you're doing, Liz, going on with that paper in Rochester, it's the exact opposite. And we've got to figure out how to spread the word that we need to build new relationships in new ways with the public. Nokia, by the way.
Absolutely.
We're working with Nokia at the City University of New York, where I teach, on an assignment tool so that if you're – it'll work with Nokia at first, but it'll work eventually with everything – where you can assign people in the field who happen to be near news events to take that picture or bring in that video or do other things. And when the information comes in, metadata is attached, what assignment it is, what story it is, plus the obvious things the phone knows, where it was taken by whom, when. And you start to get to a new idea of how we gather and share news using these mobile devices if we think mobily.
I think for us, you know, it was interesting, the whole culture clash between academia and, you know, a commercial news organization was a challenge in and of itself. But one of the things I hadn't realized till we started working closely with the paper is how much of a firewall there is, and understandably, between the business side of the paper and the news side of the paper. And for us, what happened was the news side totally got it. You know, the VP of news was a huge supporter of this. The managing editor was, you know, the main push for it there. But the business people didn't quite get what we were doing, didn't
That's
really understand the way to monetize it, right? So this has been a frustration for us because the news people aren't allowed to go out and ask for money because that taints the process, but the business people didn't understand it well enough to really work with us on it. And what we really want to do after this is done, I mean, our role on the academic side is then to say, how do we make this understandable for the business people? How do we write this up in a way that they can make sense of it, that it's not just a bunch of words and buzzwords, but that it's actually a plan for how can you make this a part of your business plan?
Matt and Gina, do you play Foursquare, either of you?
I don't.
It seems like one of those funny this week. It's similar, isn't it? I mean, I don't play it either, and I feel like I'm left out of some game that's going on in Rochester.
Well, Foursquare seems like this great business in terms of you know, it's wonderful, especially for single people. You know, like they joke about Facebook often started out kind of as a way for people to meet each other. And, you know, if you base your product on women wanting to meet men and men wanting to meet women, that's not an awful business model. So, but, you know, I'm married, so Foursquare doesn't hold quite as much appeal to me. So
I always feel so old. I don't want to, you know, broadcast my location. And I'm just like, well, that just proves I'm getting old.
Well, you know, well,
plus,
we're
I get irritated with the messages. Go ahead, Liz.
We're getting lots of families and couples playing the game. You know, the newspaper said we want to target young professionals, but what we're really getting is, you know, we have, you know, over 2,000 registered authenticated users, but many of those represent groups of 2, 3, or 4 people where whole families are playing together. And I think that's one of the things that's, you know, important in areas that aren't New York City or San Francisco or Seattle. And that's the thing with Foursquare is you have to live in a big city. If I try to log into Foursquare here in Rochester, it says, it looks like you're closer to New York than any place else. So we'll check you in New York City, which doesn't really help me all that much. So targeting the families and the couples here has been really, really exciting for us that we're getting multi-generational use of the game.
Well, the thing that I think could sell to the business guys at the paper is Google this week, maybe Matt, you can explain this better than I can, added more rich ad functionality to AdSense on mobile devices. Eric Schmidt has said in the past that Google will end up making more money on mobile than it makes on the web, and it makes more money than God on the web. So mobile has a huge priority. Matt, do you know anything about where this is headed?
You know, I just know that there's a lot of different functionality for mobile. If you think about it, things are still in flux. So there's applications, there's potentially Flash, things like banner ads. And I think until things are more settled, you want to support as much functionality as possible. So different formats of ads, different sizes of ads, different ways for people to sort of fetch and get metrics and analytics on their ads, all those sorts of things. So I think, as I recall, this most recent launch sort of basically increases the number of options that people have. So if you're writing an application or if you're working on a mobile device as a developer, you can sort of offer a wider or a different variety of potential ad choices. And eventually, the world will sort of settle on what we think as the standard way that people expect to get mobile ads. But until that happens, I think it makes sense to be as open as possible and explore that space quite a bit.
Out of left field, Matt, a question. Since you're the chief cop of spam, does mobile have an advantage in the spam world because identity is set, or does it have the same perils as anything else?
You know, it's really funny because when people ask me about mobile spam, mostly they're worried about what if I show different content to mobile phones than to desktops, which is natural and is perfectly fine. When there is identity, when there is location, it's harder to fake things. You know, you can't pretend to be in Seattle when you're really in Bulgaria or China or something like that. So there's also the fact that there's usually a billing relationship. Someone has to pay for that phone, so they're a little bit harder to fake. So even if you go and sign up for Gmail, for example, oftentimes we will offer the option to SMS a PIN code to you. And then that just sort of says, you know what? It's hard to get a lot of different phone numbers. It's hard to get the ability to use a lot of different phone numbers. So a lot of sites, not only Google, I think probably Craigslist and other sites also sort of have looked at using phone numbers or mobile cell phones as a way to sort of cut down on some of that spam. And it can work very well.
Indeed. I remember Leo confessed a few weeks ago that he needed phone numbers to get Gmail addresses to be able to get various Wave invitations. Right, Gina?
Yeah, I think he said he needed separate phone numbers for different voice accounts, which makes sense. You know, just this week I signed up for Google App Engine, which is a developer tool. And in order to do so, I had to give it my cell phone number and it SMS'd me a verification code. And, you know, because they're doling out, CPU, bandwidth, database, disk space. So I guess they kind of have to verify, one App Engine account for, per developer. And so, yeah, that's pretty interesting. But the thing is, I kind of want to be able to fake my location if I want to. Like, I want to be able to say, maybe not that I'm in San Francisco if I'm in Bulgaria, but I like the idea of being able to say I'm in the San Diego area versus, I'm on this the corner of this street and this street just for, for obvious privacy reasons.
Yeah. Absolutely. And in fact, if you go to Google Latitude, we have the ability to not only say, don't just pinpoint me to within a tiny little area, but say I'm at this city, for example. And you have the ability to go to a web page and say, I might be in San Diego, but I can say that I'm in Salt Lake City, Utah, which is really quite helpful. So there's granularity not just in who you choose to share information with, but also there's granularity in whether you show information and where you say you are and at what level of detail, which I think is very healthy. And I think the Latitude folks have really thought about how to make that a useful functionality so that people don't feel those sorts of concerns. At the same time, the ability to do SMS can be kind of helpful just to know you're sort of talking to a real person. So, for example, Google's local business center used to send postcards and sometimes still can, but you can also get an SMS or, get a phone call that says your PIN is, and now you go to a web page and you type in this number. And that's just really helpful because the spammers find it harder to get a lot of different phone numbers.
What's interesting too, Matt, is the back to this notion of the annotated world. Gina, I think if I could not only decide when to say how accurate my location is, but also when to associate it with data. If it's some thought of mine, I don't want geo associated with it. But if I'm going to review a restaurant, I want geo associated with it. If I'm going to send in a news story to Liz's colleague newspaper, they're going to require me to say where I am to kind of prove that I'm there and that the picture is legit.
Right, right. But then it becomes a question is like, how accurate then is that data? You know what I mean? If it's easy to fuzz it, can a newspaper really use that as an eyewitness account? Can a reporter use that as an eyewitness account if it's just got a couple of, longitude and latitude coordinates attached to it that it wouldn't be that easy to change, that difficult to change?
You almost want to be able to just turn on the verified geo when you feel you need it and just turn it off and say what you want to say. And if people can see which is which, you know, that seems to solve some problems.
That's true. That is true.
Well, this ties into the discussion, I think, 2 weeks ago about Twitter and Geo.
Yeah.
This week, we also had discussion that Twitter is talking to both Google and, I think, Bing, right, about, say, the rumors about turning over the database. And what does this do to the potential of live search, whether it's Google or Bing, I don't care. But since Twitter is right now that, is that putting Twitter in the cloud? Is that kind of making Twitter irrelevant in this? What would that mean if it happened?
Well, and I can't speak to what deals, you know, Twitter might be going on. Not that I would even know them as one thing, but it is sort of interesting that, you know, Google and Bing both crawl Twitter. So, you know, I don't know what percentage of Twitter we're able to crawl, but we are able to crawl a fairly large amount. And to the extent that you expect anybody that's important would get retweeted, and so you'll sort of see that information. I think that there's definitely it's definitely the case that we can already crawl a pretty interesting fraction, enough to sort of do some fun real-time stuff. But, you know, whenever you go to Twitter and you type something in, that goes into Twitter's database. And so, you know, if even if you have a feed, you can't change that feed page. You can't point it to a hub or PubSubHubHub or anything like that, at least not by default or any way that I know. So it's in Twitter's databases. It's in Twitter silo. And so it would be up to them about how to release that data.
Right.
Gina, what do you think the impact is?
Well, so let's think about live Twitter search results and Google results. Well, first you have geo data when they turn on geo, right? So regular web pages don't generally have geo data, but Twitter search results do. And so this is a situation I always use, or an example I always use with Twitter search results. I'm on the West Coast, so American Idol or different reality shows air 3 hours earlier on the East Coast. So if I search for American Idol winner, you know, at 6 p.m. my time, when I know it's out on the East Coast, in regular Google search results, and Matt, you can correct me if I'm wrong, you generally can't find the winner before it's aired. But if Twitter search results are integrated there, I'll know the winner before it airs. So you just get that, you know, that instant answer.
Yeah, it's historically Google likes to do algorithmic stuff. We don't tend to do a one box that says, okay, here's who won American Idol or who is winning the Emmys, that sort of thing. Although this week we did do a poison control. So it turns out there's one single 1-800 number that works for all of the United States. So if anybody types in poison control, they'll get a little one box. So we don't do those very often. But for example, earlier today I Twittered that I was going to be on Twig later today. And just doing a search for Matt Cutts this week in Google, I see it 1, 2, 3, 4. Result number 5, I see, you know, my snippet. I'm going to be on this week in Google later today. So we've already crawled my page on Twitter and seen that. So we're relatively good at finding fresh stuff pretty quickly.
Yeah,
Twitter has got it first, but
yeah, I think Google's pretty good at search. I don't know. In general,
well,
that's
but
true.
No, but I think you're right, Gina. Google's always been weak at live. It needs content to ferment, as I say, like wine or cheese.
And there's metadata too. Like Matt, you know, Matt, I assume that there are Twitter accounts that like echo your tweets or maybe even modify them. Like if you had a verified account, I mean, there's certain metadata that Twitter has in their database that could be available to Google. I mean, I suppose that they could embed it in the page in a certain way that Google's, you know, that the Google bot would get anyway, because, you know, the Google bot's pretty good, as we said. But it seems like it might be, I don't know, you know, you'd have identity geo information and it might show up a little bit faster. I don't know. I'd be interested to know. I mean, what is the lag time between something, a tweet gets published on Twitter, you have a pretty popular Twitter account, and it shows up on Google, about how long do you think that takes?
You know, I don't think it takes very long. Certainly if Twitter has the fire hose, they have the full database. And so, you know, any information that any random person tweets, they have it very, very quickly because they get it directly. But there was a really good interview that came out in Business Week this week with Amit Singhal, who's my office mate. He's the head of Google's core ranking. And he talked for about 2 or 3 paragraphs about our philosophy of real time, of live, whatever you want to call it. And what he basically said is that Twitter is a very large chunk of what gets produced in terms of real time information. But suppose there's an embargo, you know, and at 9 p.m. something goes live and the embargo is lifted. If somebody's worked really hard to write a good blog post and at 9:01 they hit the submit button, in our opinion, that's basically real time as well. So our philosophy on ranking tends to be more or less a window to sort of say, okay, show me very recent results. So for example, if you do a search, you can click the show options link, and then we'll show you the ability to see things within recent results, essentially. So you can search past 24 hours or even the past hour. So historically, Twitter absolutely is where a lot of real-time content gets created, but it's not the only place. You know, a good blog post can be considered real-time, in our opinion. And mm-hmm. so we sort of provide those options, and our philosophy is more along the lines of rank anything useful on the web that looks pretty reputable within a very short time window, and that can be considered real-time.
Mm-hmm. Have both of you seen Tinker.com? Tinker was started by Glam. Glam is the largest women's brand network online. It kind of, I think, blew up the model of media online by creating networks instead of owning content, which is a model for news. But that's subject of another day. They got all fascinated with the idea of the live web and what was going on here. So they started Tinker.com, which categorizes Twitter news feeds, now associates it with Reuters news. And there, I had dinner with Samir Arora, the CEO of Glam this week, and they're finding, of course, no surprise, that the news is coming much faster from Twitter than from other sources, including, you know, Google News, so that now they're exchanging feeds with Reuters because Reuters wants the heads up to news that Twitter provides, and Tinker wants the context that Reuters provides.
Right. I mean, I think the embargo example that Matt gave is a really good one, right? Because that blog post is written, and at 9 p.m., the submit, you know, the publish button gets pressed. But for the most part, the things that happen, things that don't have that kind of planning or lead time, Twitter, you know, the Twitter news is going to be out there faster just because it takes a lot less time to write 140 characters, right?
And Twitter is fantastic. I mean, one thing that's wonderful is how Twitter lowered the barrier so that regular people are creating and making content. So, you know, if a bear goes crazy at the zoo, or if a guy in downtown Palo Alto is walking around with a gun, which, you know, I've seen both those examples, you'll have, you know, one out of 20 or whatever the fraction is of the people will have a Twitter account. And so absolutely a ton of content does get created there. And Twitter is fantastic to find out, especially about a breaking event or when something just happened. I think where it can get a little bit more muddy is 10 hours after that tsunami or 10 hours after that breaking event. And then when you search, if you're only sorting by date, then you'll tend to get, you know, whatever one random person happened to say about that. Whereas you mm-hmm. might want to get useful links and okay, what are the resources that are the biggest source of reputable information and stuff like that.
That's so where Geo is definitely a trade-off.
Yeah.
When Geo comes in, you're going to have some sense of what's happening if it's legit. And then it becomes a matter of people talking about it rather than telling about it.
Right. Take the example of Obama, though. That's doesn't have as much of a geo focus. So, you know, I heard about Obama getting the Nobel Prize on Twitter because I happened to be surfing there first. And so finding out a breaking piece of information is fantastic. But then a day later, you'll probably, if you search for Obama Nobel Prize, you'll get more or less random samplings of what people are saying. So it's always this trade-off of real-time versus perspective, I think.
Well, it's a gathering mechanism for gathering news from witnesses. It's a distribution mechanism for sharing that news. And then it's a discussion mechanism, right?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that news got pushed to you, right, Matt? I mean, you happen to be on Twitter and that news got pushed to you. You didn't know to search for it.
Right.
One question about integrating Twitter, Twitter search results in Bing or Google. I mean, would for example, probably this, I'm not sure this is a question you can answer, but would Google use Twitter metadata like the number of followers you have, or whether or not you're a verified account, or you know how many tweets you have? Would you use that to rank results? Would somebody with a verified account and 50,000 followers and very few followees or friends, would that person get a higher ranking in results? You know, theoretically.
Right now, we don't. So what we find is the people that have a lot of followers tend to attract a lot of links anyway. And the important Twitter posts or micro tweets, whatever you want to call them, micro blogging items, those tend to go ahead and attract links. So you could certainly look at a lot of different factors, and Twitter would have a lot of it, judging, you know, anything from when someone joined Twitter to how many replies they get to how many followers they have. So you could probably build a pretty good source of reputation for an individual Twitter user. And even if you're not Twitter, you could probably do a relatively good job of that. And I'm sure that some of the real-time mm-hmm. search engines try to do that. With Google, just going purely by PageRank gets us about 90, 95% of the way there. So we don't do anything special or different in ranking Twitter pages or Facebook pages or any social media like that.
Right, because when you reply to someone on Twitter, the metadata is says in reply to this tweet, and it's a link back to that individual tweet. So that would contribute to PageRank. So PageRank scales is what you're saying.
PageRank scales. And the nice thing is it's not just replies or links within Twitter. It's also a lot of people will link to tweets or, you know, friend feed will link to a specific tweet. And so just from crawling the web, you can find a lot of good information that way.
Right.
Before we get off Twitter, it was the oddest. We had, by the way, I don't think we had a Google downtime this week, but we had Twitter half down. I don't know if you experienced this in your time zone, but I found that I was only seeing my own tweets. I thought it was a new killer app that I could talk to myself. Who needs the world? Have you heard any story about what this down was? Because it was so strange. It was only parts of it were down. I could see replies to me, but I couldn't see my feed.
Yeah, I think the Twitter status blog said that an edge case with a particular service that Twitter uses had happened and something had gone down. And yeah, that's what happened to me. My timeline was just stale. I saw my own tweets, but no one else's. I saw replies. It was weird. It was like everybody left the room. It was like everybody left the party, but it wasn't down.
Was it something I said?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was definitely interesting down edge. I'd rather just have the fail whale straight up, you know, than that happen again.
Matt, you talked about that Business Week article before about Google and search, and I know you tweeted it this week, and there were a lot of really interesting things in that about how Google tests. Can you talk about that for a few minutes?
Sure, absolutely. So there was an interview with Scott Huffman, who's the head of our evaluation team, and Rob Hoff, who wrote the article, did a very good job of drilling down and saying, give more examples. So we basically talked about how we evaluate search quality. So for example, one sort of secret that I gave was that I always keep a notebook in my back pocket. So if I'm at a local arts fair, I'm collecting the names of these little tiny mom and pop artists, the ones who have AOL email addresses who are not necessarily all that savvy. And so if you search for their name and, you know, photography or whatever, you want to return their website. So they don't even know it, but we're trying to check our quality by looking at whether we return these little tiny mom and pop businesses that maybe only have one or two links or don't even have any links. And then Scott talked a little bit about, you know, we'll do A-B testing. So we'll sort of show you one set of results most of the time, but a very small percentage of users will get an experiment. And if the click-through is radically better on this experimental group or radically worse, then that tells us something as well. So we have a whole bunch of different experiments that we run as well as different query sets. And so if you expect a certain result to show up and it doesn't show up, somebody usually finds out about that and starts immediately debugging and figures out, okay, is the site down or was it something on our side? And we find a lot of bugs before anybody even notices that they're bugs.
Now, one thing that surprised me was the human impact of this. I think it surprised Rob as well, that you have a lot of human testers doing these quality control checks around the world for a not bad hourly rate, by the way. How does that work?
Yeah. The idea is whenever we have a new change, we'd like to know whether it's an improvement or not. And so in order to do that, we'll actually, you know, create a production system that can rank the results differently. And then we basically show the two results side by side and we say, okay, you as an expert rater, you know, you're in Japan, you actually live in Japan, you know what should be the result for this hospital or for this particular query, which set of results is better? And it's blind, so they don't know what they're evaluating. They don't know which side is which. They don't know anything about it. All they know is, okay, I think left side is better, right side is better, whatever. And so by having those sorts of ratings, those sort of side-by-side ratings in really dozens of different languages, we're able to spot problems. So, you know, you don't just roll out a change because it works well in English, because it might break something in Chinese or Spanish or French or Italian or German. So there's a ton of different raters who help us out just by sort of evaluating the results side by side and saying, I think this is better or I think that this is worse.
Do those result in small modifications as you go, or they become part of the next big build?
We tend to do things in small incremental changes. So if you look at Bing, they tend to launch on more like a every 6 month sort of schedule. We tend to launch more on the order of, you know, 6 to 8 to 10 things per week. So we have a meeting every week, every Thursday, where we sort of talk about all the proposed changes and either approve them or table them or send them back to, you know, get more details or to tweak the algorithm a little bit better. So in the same way you could think of a car as a machine, you know, there is one algorithm that sort of ranks all of Google search results, but a car is composed of a bunch of different parts, and those parts are also algorithms. So we do try to make these changes very incrementally, and most of the time people don't even notice, which is a little bit discouraging. You know, you make some huge improvement in how you do Chinese or Italian, and sure, people like the results better, but they don't really, it's not such a huge difference that they notice. And so what we do is we've just started to blog a little bit more about sort of even just the UI changes that we've done in the last week or two. We've realized that unless we talk about some of these changes, some of which are subtle, even if they're involving the user interface, people won't always notice them.
How often do you have to roll back a change because you have an oops?
It's pretty rare. And in fact, it's very rare. What's more likely is you have a binary that goes out that has some problem with performance, or, you know, maybe you found a way that one query could crash that binary. So we do a bunch of stuff to avoid having the problems of downtime or brownouts or going to Google and nothing shows up. Those tend to be the sorts of things that you send out a test binary and you find out there's a problem and you have to revert that. As far as search quality changes, we do a bunch of evaluation before things launch to make sure that it's safe. We do occasionally roll back, but it's really not that often.
One of our traditions here on Twig is to not talk about Google Books because we don't have Siva Vaidyanathan here. I tried to get Siva again this week, and we didn't, but I think we have to at least hit the topic a little bit. By the way, my son Jake says the Google Books search discussion is boring. Never talk about it. So maybe it's like what he says. But this week we did have Sergey Brin's op-ed in the New York Times defending Google Book Search. And I think, Matt, it was you who sent me, put up a tweet saying you had a reason to know why he really wrote it.
Well, just the fact that he made this joke, you know, that something limited consumer choice, like consumer choice in unicorns is limited, which is just a very Sergey thing to say. He was essentially making the point that in the same way that unicorns don't really exist, there really wasn't any choice before you had the ability to get access to these books using Google Book Search, because unless you happened to live right next to a major research library, there was no way you were going to be able to get to see that book. So that was, most of the op-ed was very well reasoned and very polite, and he quoted a few historical books, which was fun, but you could see a little bit of Sergey come through in that sentence.
That unicorn line is my favorite, for sure. Sorry, Jeff, but that unicorn line, like, got me, I have to say. I have to say that op-ed convinced me. I thought it was pretty even-handed and well-written and well-reasoned. Actually, Liz, I'm interested to know what you think about the Google Books situation, if you've been keeping up on it.
All right, so you're going to put me on the spot here because I'm the librarian and I've been so busy building and running a game for the past 3 months that I can't do anything else. So
I know you're the librarian. This is why I'm asking.
To get caught up.
Well, I won't put you on the spot because I know you've been running the game, but I know that you're coming from Microsoft and the whole Google digitizing all the books in the world. I'm curious to know what the librarian thinks of that, but I won't put you on the spot if you're not.
I mean, I can respond. I can't respond to anything new that's okay. Going on with it right now, but you know, I can give my general sense, which is that it makes me really, really nervous to have all that content centralized and owned by a single entity. And you know, one of the things I love about libraries is their deeply decentralized approach to content. And it's so the librarian in me worries a lot about all of the content being controlled in one central source instead of by consortiums or collaborative groups that have, you know, competing stakes and therefore some incentive to address each other's needs. So there's a low level discomfort for me of commercially owned books.
Well, we still have to get Siva on. I agree with you, Gina and Matt. I liked the op-ed. I said so on Twitter. And then Siva came in. I can't find it right now, but he went onto my Facebook page where the tweet had gone and had a little rant about it. So we'll get him on. Another tradition here at This Week in Google is that we have to talk about Wave. So
yes!
Gina's suggestion, let's inaugurate a new feature called This Week in Wave.
I know, Jeff, I know you and Matt are on Wave. Liz, have you gotten into the Wave preview? Are you using Wave?
I received my first invitation into Wave on Friday. And
oh, cool.
I have not yet accepted it. I tried to accept it from my phone, and it said, you absolutely may not do this on your phone. Go home and use your computer.
You don't want to do it on your phone.
And so I actually, as you started talking, I said, oh, I should pull up that invitation and log in. But I'll be honest with you, I have no idea from anything that I've read why I want to be in it. So if you could enlighten me as to why this would be useful to me, that'd be lovely.
There's actually, there's a fantastic website. What's it called? It's a Wave, easier to understand than Wave, or?
What? Yeah, it's easier to understand than Sarah Palin.
Yeah, easier to understand than or what is the actual URL?
I'm going down right now. It's in our feed. Oh, where the hell is it? Damn, hold on one second.
Anyway, it is a website that basically compares Google Wave against a whole host of inexplicable things, like Sarah Palin, like women was in there. I don't know really.
Here we go. I got a TechCrunch. 230 people, 49% said Google Wave was easier to understand than Sarah Palin, which was 51%. Google Wave is easier to understand than Obama's Nobel Peace Prize, than the United States tax code, than Scientology, than women. And that was it for the suggestion. Yeah,
it's
Google Wave is
like,
hard,
it's like-
Liz, but I think that I wrote a post I'll send to you. Also, the LA Times had a good feature about how Google Wave can have a real impact on news. It's collaborative. It's real time. A closed group can collaborate on it, and soon they'll be able to publish to the web. So I think you can blow the brains of your friends down there at the Rochester Democrat with an idea of a new way. When you turn them to what they should go next is two-way news and collaborating between journalists and witnesses, Wave is going to be an incredible tool, we think.
I love that.
I see a couple of people from our newspaper as I just logged into it, and in my contact list, I see a couple of people from our local newspaper already in there and playing with it. So, you know, I will say that as someone who has had to, because it makes me so depressed, stop reading any comment posted to a newspaper article, I am hopeful that something that's perhaps tied to a more permanent identity than what most newspaper comments offer could perhaps improve the quality of discourse, because after the election, I just said, that's it. I can never again read another comment on a newspaper article because they're just awful. The quality of discourse is pathetic on most
comments. Liz, you're right. But the problem is, I think that is still kind of a centralized view of news that says, okay, here's what we've done. Now enough about you. Comment on what we've done. When that's all you allow is interactivity. Whereas if we really truly turn to collaboration, if we have projects and journalism that we do together with the community and try to accomplish something Wikipedia-like, that's a whole different kind of respect for the community and a different kind of collaboration. And I think that's the next, pardon me, wave of interaction. Gina, have you done anything new with Wave since we last talked?
Well, last week we were talking about how difficult or easy it is to extend Wave. And this week I actually dove into the API and made my first Wave bot. So there are two ways to extend Wave: bots and gadgets. And yes, Wave is complex and many things are easier to understand than that. And the website is actually easier to understand than wave.com. It's basically a hot or not for like how confusing Wave can be, which I found thoroughly amusing. But I made my first bot this week, and there's a Java API and a Python API. It was super simple. It was an afternoon's worth of work. It doesn't do anything very useful. I haven't done anything very complex with it yet. But yeah, I'm kind of hopped up. I'm jazzed up about Wave right now because I did a little bit of development, and a few of my friends are in. And actually, Jeff and I used Wave before this show because we were both very nervous about Leo not being here. So we were frantically waving together like, oh God, what are we going to talk about? Okay.
And with just two of us, it worked pretty well, didn't it?
It did work very quite well. And it was really fun to watch your cursor dancing around, you know, 20 minutes before the show and to add to different sections. I thought it worked actually quite well. And I've got a couple of, you know, real documents and outlines that I'm working on with coworkers now in Wave because I have the privilege of working with nerds that actually got into the preview. And I'm liking it. I'm liking it very much. I mean, I think it is still very complex and difficult to understand, but I'm into it. And Matt, since you're at Google, I wanted to ask you this question, which it was basically the same question I asked you about Android a few shows ago. Internally at Google, how much is Wave in use? Does every employee have an invite? Are people ditching Gmail for it? How do you see it happening inside the castle?
Yeah, definitely one of the best things about Google that I just can't get enough of is the ability to dog food stuff before anybody else. So if you're interested in that at Google, you can usually get access to fun stuff, you know, things like Wave. So there's a lot of people, especially in the early days of Wave, they said you can convert, you know, a whole team if you guys are all kind of willing to tackle it together. And what I love is it's especially good for collaboration. So if you're working on a document or there's something where you're both going to be polishing it out, then it's fantastic. And so there's a lot of people that have been using it for that. Yeah, I sort of feel like I need to mount a spirited defense of Wave when everybody says it's all this super complex sort of stuff, because the announcement video was about an hour, but it was because they wanted to take you through all the features. And I sort of feel like, okay, multiple people connect up to one server, they can chat in real time, and they're, you know, has the ability in the server to sort of watch stuff go over the wire and add and augment and make things better. And there's more structure. So it's not just raw text. You can add images. You can, you know, it, all that stuff is saved. I feel like there is an essence of Wave, which some people have seen because they have friends. Like when you can collaborate, you can really start to see the potential. And when you can write a bot, you can really start to see part of the power. So I think a few people are sort of judging by the current user interface, which is not really the most fair. You know, that's mm-hmm. a good start. But I think the power is in sort of the idea and in the direction that they go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Agreed. I'm sold. You don't have to defend Wave to me. I'm sold. I feel a little bit like everybody in my kind of productivity circles are like, this is just another distracting thing. And I'm like, but it's so cool. And, you know, whatever. So it's going to take some time, I think, to get the elevator pitch right and to get, and for people to, I mean, it's only as good as, you know, who else is in it with you and who will collaborate with you. And I think as people actually start to use it for things other than saying, hi, I'm waving. This is me waving. How do you use this? You know, the utility reveals itself.
I think it's very RSS-like in that way, that people still don't know what it stands for, and it doesn't matter what it stands for. You see it in all kinds of useful things, and it really works. And Liz, as a journalism teacher, I'm dying for someone to start developing news applications with this. So get finished with the darn game, and let's talk. Because I think that you and your team, because it is collaborative, it is social, it's about creating new things, it's about taking the newspaper to the next step. We can make beautiful music together here, Liz.
All right. Call me.
All right. So we're going to keep going in a moment with our other traditions of Twig. But first, we have a word from Leo, who has a word from our sponsor. So let's see if Eric's ready to play that.
Thanks, guys. More Twig in a bit. But first, I want to tell you about GoToAssist. GoToAssist Express. We used GoToAssist, the earlier version of GoToAssist, way back when. I think on the screensavers to help people. But really, it has been redesigned. It is a very great product for people who are in customer support or IT. If you're, you know, there's nothing worse. Believe me, I know better than anyone than trying to support people over the phone. With GoToAssist Express, there's another way, a better way. It's online tech support for your customers or clients over the internet. You view and control another person's computer online. Of course, it's from Citrix. They know how to do this kind of remote access, but this is designed specifically for IT pros. You can fix a technical problem quickly and remotely without being there. You can access files on the remote computer, transfer files from your computer to theirs to fix the problem, run up to 8 unattended sessions at the same time, or attended. But the beauty of the 8 sessions is you start an install, you start a fix, a scan, move to the next machine. You're never waiting for something to finish. And your customers, no, it's unattended. They do not have to be there. You do have full chat and so forth, so you can talk to them while you're working with their machine, but they don't have to be there. Get a complete assay of the software on the system and on and on and on. All sorts of great features built in for you from GoToAssist. I want you to try it now. Go to gotoassist.com/twig and try it absolutely free for 30 days. gotoassist.com/twig. Try it free for 30 days. You'll see. You'll be a support hero. Go to assist.com/twig. We thank them for their support of This Week in Google. Now back to Jeff and Gina and the gang.
Thank you, Leo. We miss you. But he's probably having a great time eating kebabs in Dubai for TEDx. All right, we're going to go now to our final traditions now, which is the tip of the week, the number of the week, and Gina suggests we bring back the wish list. So, Gina, why don't you start with your tip of the week?
My tip of the week is actually a feature that came out a few weeks ago, but I think we were too preoccupied with Wave during the show to mention it. The new version of Picasa 3.5 has facial recognition built in. And iPhoto has had this for a while. I've never been a big iPhoto fan, but I was really excited to see it come out in Picasa. I upgraded to Picasa 3.5. It scans, you know, gigabytes and gigabytes of photos that I have since, you know, 1998. And it does a creepily good job of identifying faces and grouping your pictures by face. For me, it did better on adults than children. Like I have pictures of my nephews, and when they were babies, they all kind of look similar. So you can correct, you know, what faces it identifies and categorizes as a person. But it makes suggestions, you can confirm them. It's a really, really cool, and it's also an excellent way to see how bad and how good your hair has been over the years. Because you get to see lots of different hairstyles all grouped together in a grid. So Picasa facial recognition, and this isn't really a cloud tip, but it kind of is, because Picasa hooks into Picasa Web Albums, which is, you know, Picasa's online hosted albums. Now, I confess, I prefer Flickr over Picasa Web Albums, but Picasa Web Albums also has facial recognition. There are some limits on how much you can upload to Picasa Web Albums for free, but you can also do facial recognition there and tag faces with people from your contacts. So it's a really cool feature, and I encourage you, if you or Picasa use it, to turn it on, because you'll unearth pictures of people over time. It's really neat to see people change over time and try out different hairstyles. So that's my tip of the week.
That's beautiful. And we want to see your makeup styles over the period of Twig here. And your bike movements and find meaning in that. Wasn't there also an announcement this week that Google was creating kind of an internal cloud that lets you integrate Picasa and Docs and other things? I only have that in the back of my brain. Gina, do you know more about that?
Yeah, there was a post on, I think, Google Operating System, and then a follow-up blog post that sort of hints at the ability to upload and share lots of different data and different data types. And if you look at, for example, sites.google.com, they've really added the ability to add more and more things to that page, you know, Picasa albums and stuff like that. So I think Google Operating System spotted it first, and so we went ahead and blogged about it. But there's just more ability to sort of upload stuff and store it. So I think that's the trend.
It's Google Sites, Matt, right?
I think that one is Google Sites, yes.
It's Google Sites, yeah. Cool.
All right, so I'm going to give you advance warning, Liz. We're going to go for the wish list in a minute, so think of something you want. But first, we'll do the number of the week. And my number of the week is 1 billion squared. We had Google say this week that YouTube far surpasses the serving that various measurement services had guessed. And says that they're serving 1 billion videos a day. It's like 1 billion McDonald's hamburgers every day, which is incredible. We also have Eric Schmidt in a deposition saying that he knows, yes, he overpaid for YouTube by about $1 billion, same number, but said it was worth it and necessary so that he could grab it away from the competitors. And I think that's coming true. So there's my number of the week. Now on to wish lists. Matt, you want to lead us off here? What's something you wish for in our cloudy world?
Absolutely. I wish that we would crawl Ajax. And in fact, we've been taking some steps toward that. So at the SMX conference in New York that Danny Sullivan puts on, which is a great search conference, we proposed a method to crawl Ajax. And it's not as if we'll crawl your Gmail without permission. You have to make a few changes to your Ajax URLs. Instead of just having a hash mark and then state after that, you'd have to have a hash mark and then an exclamation point. So it's not as if Google's going to index your Ajax without your permission. But in the same way that people want to be able to do Flash, they want to be able to do rich media, and they want search engines to keep up, I think it would be fantastic if search engines would be able to crawl Ajax. And my wish is that the proposal is well received, we get good feedback, and then, you know, in a few weeks or a month or whenever, we can sort of nail that down a little bit more and start pushing the web forward a little bit.
Matt, how would that work? Would the Googlebot actually parse the JavaScript and see where the AJAX calls, where the dynamic calls for data were coming from, or how?
Well, and you know, that would be the science fiction in the limit. And Googlebot can parse some JavaScript, but not to the degree that we'd be able to do that quite yet. So the proposal is basically that you have a, they call it a headless browser, which means when someone comes to one of these special URLs, and it doesn't matter whether it's Googlebot or whether it's whether a user, essentially the web server will run the JavaScript, figure out what the final HTML will be, and then take that HTML snapshot and return that. And that's what the Googlebot or users can sort of see and index. But then Googlebot can sort of send you to the AJAX URL directly with any luck.
Ooh, fancy.
I love that. And I think it gets us into the whole new kind of pay past the page web, right? The idea that Marissa's been talking about, we've talked about a lot in the show, of the hyper-personal news stream, Twitter search. It gets you into a whole new dimension of search that's kind of Rod Serling-ness, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and if you want, I can throw a quick tip in.
Please.
I was ready. I could throw out a number or a tip or a wish. So
throw a wall out, man.
Well, okay. Quick tip. You might not have noticed this, but if you go to Google and you do a search, for example, for a product, if you do a search like Kindle, there's a little line that appears above the search results called options or show options. We sort of call it the tool belt. And if you click that, one of the new options is fewer shopping sites. So one of the common complaints we get is people do not want to get, show options, and then way down in there is fewer shopping results. So you can choose more shopping results if you want to do some comparison shopping, or if you want reviews of your Kindle or iPod or LCD TV or whatever it is, you're more likely to get Engadget and people talking about it rather than people trying to sell it to you. So that's a very common request, and I'm glad that we can sort of provide that functionality. I think that's a pretty fun tip.
Number two?
Yeah, a number, absolutely. 1 million, which is the number of views we're about to hit on our webmaster video channel. So we've made about 150 little 2-minute short videos that answer common people's questions. If you do a Google search for webmaster video channel, it's the first result from YouTube. And when we hit exactly 1 million, which will happen in the next week or so, we're going to post a fun video. I think people will enjoy it.
Wonderful. By the way, I want to note that the chat room is debating now what a billion squared is. I'm delighted to see that. Liz, I've already given my wish, which is, Liz, I want you to learn Wave and work on it with news. That's my wish. What's your wish?
My wish is I wish that Google Docs supported mail merge, because it's the one thing that keeps me from moving a lot of my workflow into Google Docs, is that I am deeply dependent on being able to merge spreadsheet, word processing, and email together. And without those, that capability, without the mail merge capability, I can't use Google Docs for anything serious. And so I really hope that that's coming.
Gina, that's a great wish.
That's a good one. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
So my wish, and this is kind of cool because I can hassle Matt about it a little bit, although I know, Matt, I don't think this is what you do specifically, but my wish has to do with Google Groups. I run a few Google Groups for a couple of open source projects and other things, and there's a spam problem. And it makes me so sad because Gmail is so good at spam, at dealing with spam, and there just aren't controls for Google Groups, as many controls as I'd like. So I've had to make my Google Groups lists, approval only. So I have to approve every message from a new user. So if you want to run a an open group, basically I have to green light every single post that goes through, so I avoid the Viagra and check out my webcam messages that go out a lot more than I thought. So better spam filtering and more and easier filtering options. Like, I'd like to just be able to say, any message that contains the word Viagra or has excessive links, to moderate, to put that aside for moderation automatically.
That's a very good wish. I'm more than happy to pass that on, because I think I know some of the people working in that area, and I know that they have gotten much better about spam on groups, but it's not completely finished. So I can definitely go and sort of check with people and ask what's up, and sort of, are there any new things coming down the pipe that might help with that?
Excellent. Friends in high places. Excellent. Thank you.
A happy ending to Twig number 11. I want to thank our wonderful panelists, always Gina Trapani of SmarterWare.org, Liz Lawley from the Rochester Institute of Technology. And I'm sorry, Liz, give me your URL for the project again.
PictureTheImpossible.com.
And, of course, Matt Cutts, who's kind enough to come in from Google and show off his new do. And I also want to thank the folks in the chat room who were very kind and not making fun of the fact that I'm Leo Light. So, Leo, come back. We need you. Thank you very much. And that's another Twig.